Andy, the floor is yours.
Michael Duenas and Doris Lotz from the Improving Healthcare Systems panel. And we also have someone from the Disparities panel, don't we? Sorry. My apologies to the member of the Disparities panel. Perhaps you could speak up and let us know if you're on the call.
Yes, this is Liz Jacobs, and I also believe that Dorian Miller from the Disparities panel will also be joining us, if she's not on the call already. Dorian? Okay, so right now it's just me, Liz Jacobs.
Thank you, Liz, and hopefully Dorian will also be able to join us. According to the information we have for people who have logged on, I've got the following members of the Assessment of Prevention, Diagnosis, and Treatment Options panel on the call, including Seema Sonad, Linda McNamara, Jim Pantelis, Alvin Mushlin, Betty Green, Marsha Rupino, Angela Smith, Marty Clayton, Cindy Milroe, Kathy Insel, and Bruce Monty. And are there other members of the panel that I did not name?
Yes, this is Deborah Madden. Hello, everybody.
Thank you, Deborah.
Yep, this is Daniel Wall.
Okay, I think we heard from Daniel and Priti, so thank you.
No, just this here thing. Which one of these things?
Oh. So we have an excellent turnout. I want to thank you. I know this is
email.
That we're appreciative of you spending part of your afternoon and for some of you part of your morning with us on this call today. And so we're gonna review sort of the purpose of this, but basically we want to have a more lengthy discussion of three different topic areas that were identified as being high priority by the PCORI Science Oversight Committee. And so I'd like to introduce Hal Sox, who is, as all of you remember, a former member of this advisory panel. And Hal is now a full-time program director at PCORI and has been working closely with the prioritization process at PCORI.
Thank you, David, and good afternoon. And I want to add my thanks to Dave's for your flexibility and patience with us. I'd like to explain why we are addressing three topics and how they fit into the big funding picture at PCORI. PCORI basically has three funding streams. One are the so-called broad topics, which are all investigator-initiated and involve roughly $2 million in funding. Then there are two other funding streams which involve a lot more money. One of them you are familiar with, which is the Pragmatic Clinical Studies Program, in which we issue a funding announcement that lists perhaps 20 high-priority topics, many of which you've been instrumental in getting to the stage of being in a funding announcement. The other type of funding announcement are what we call targeted funding announcement. And a targeted funding announcement focuses on a single topic. This coming year, we're in a position to spend something roughly around $200 million on targeted funding announcements. And for reasons that I'm not privy to, the Board of Governors of PCORI has to approve a specific slate of topics to be funded under the Targeted Funding Announcement Program. And if they don't do that, by mid-August of this year, we will be unable to spend that money during the fiscal year that starts, I guess, in the fall. So we here have been pushing hard to put through for consideration several topics, that some of which have been identified by governance, members of the board, some of which have been identified by our looking into our own portfolio and identifying topics that obviously are important and putting those forward. So that's why we're here today, is because we basically have to go through a process of review by our Science Oversight Committee and our board by mid-August. If you all could put your attention to the slide that is up right now, you'll see the process. Basically, we start with nominated topics, which can be over the transom. They can be topics that we identify through our own internal evaluation of what we funded already and governance members. These then go through a series of steps, some of which will look familiar to you, starting with determining the eligibility of the topic, and then going to a topic brief, and then going through advisory panel review, and then if you keep going all the way down to the bottom, you will have a large multi-stakeholder work group to actually fine-tune the research questions to make them as tuned, as well suited to the current funding needs as possible. And you can see that our Science Oversight Committee, which is in red, basically at every stage in this process, they want to take a look at what's going on, make sure they're comfortable with it, that we're on the right track, and so forth. So right now we are in the process of having a discussion at the advisory panel review using the topic briefs that were prepared under short notice by PCORI staff for your consideration. So in short, the reason that we're having this discussion is because we have a process that we need to work through by the middle of August. And again, we thank you for your tolerance and patience, because we ask a lot of you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Hal. So I'd now like to turn it over to Al Mushlin and Marty Clayton, our chair and co-chair, to just give a brief overview of how you see the meeting going today.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Dave and Hal. It's Al Mushlin. I'd just like to extend my thanks also to the members of the panel, both of the Assessing Options panel as well as the members that we have from Systems and from Disparities. You know, I'm looking forward to the discussion today. We obviously have three very interesting broad topics to talk about, and I'm sure we're going to enjoy and get a lot out of this discussion and hopefully give a lot back to PCORI in terms of input and advice for the process that Hal has been over. I think they've described it well. This is a little bit new for us in that two things are a bit different. One is the Science Oversight Committee is active and is along with us, and the topics that are brought to us through the staff is in the process, I think, of putting forward some very interesting topics. And the second thing that's new is I think now this session we see the definite intention of PCORI to, assuming that these topics can be refined and developed into PFAs, we see the intention of PCORI to invest a considerable amount of money to the research community in order to pursue these. So I think what we're going to do today is interesting and important. And again, my thanks to everyone for their participation. David will be going over the procedures that we're going to follow today. But now I'd just like to turn it over for a few comments to Marty.
Hi, everybody. In the interest of time, I'm just going to say what they said. Very nice, gentlemen. And as usual, we will be keeping you on time so we're not all here for cocktail hour on a Friday. Back to you, Dave.
Thank you. So I think the procedures are going to be pretty straightforward here today. I said earlier we have three topics because I was counting chronic pain as one topic, but as you can see, it's actually divided into three different sections. And so we're going to spend more time on the chronic pain area than on the other two topics. But what we'd like to do is there's going to be a person assigned to very briefly orient the rest of the group to each topic. We want that orientation to last no longer than 3 or 4 minutes. And then to open it up to a general discussion, particularly focusing on importance of the priority research questions, which sort of you'll see kind of come out at the end of each topic brief. We will be able to devote only about 20 minutes to each topic. We'll kind of see how it goes. I think we'll, if we gain some time earlier on, we may have a little more time available to us later in the session, but certainly we need to keep pretty much on schedule to get you done on time. The following this webinar, we will send to all of you a process that you're familiar with. It's basically a simple prioritization thing in which we'll ask you to prioritize the priority research questions. We are going to immediately compile the discussion of today's webinar right after the webinar is over, so that we'll be able to update those question lists before we send them out to you for voting. So I think we can go ahead and get started with the first topic. So I'd like to introduce Doris Lotz. Doris, I don't remember what state you're from, but I think it's in the Northeast. It's New Hampshire. Doris is Medicaid Medical Director in New Hampshire, does a fantastic job on these kinds of activities. And Doris is going to be able to speak briefly to the fact that this topic, the use of chronic opioids for the management of pain has been discussed at some level in the past by the Improving Healthcare Systems panel. So thank you, Doris.
All right. Well, I'll try to set the stage for the next presenters. I'll say very simply by opening, some people think that the use of opiates in the U.S. is an epidemic. There are over 100 million people in the U.S. living with chronic pain, defined as lasting more than 3 months or past the time of normal healing. That excludes cancer pain and end-of-life pain. And about 5 or 8 million of those people are using opiates for the management of their chronic pain. We've seen as well increasing deaths from overdose or narcotics use. And something that the issue brief didn't go into, but that is clearly part of the Medicaid portfolio of problems, is an increasing number of children born with neonatal addiction syndrome. So I chose to present this topic because I don't know how to stress the importance of it, particularly with the populations that I work with. It's caught the attention of many other people besides Medicaid programs, so the VA and the U.S. Health and Human Services have programs. But it's also caught the attention of the Department of Justice. We have prescription monitoring programs by way of trying to mitigate opiate use and give people the appropriate information to prescribe better as well, potentially, as to be on the outlook for diversion. And yet very little is known to guide the appropriate use of evidence or the appropriate use of opioids that's evidence-based. So how to maximize the effectiveness and minimize the harm? What are the long-term effectiveness of long-term opiate use? How should doses be initiated, titrated, tapered? Who's at risk for either adverse events or, you know, who are the best candidates for opiate use? We also don't know much from the literature as far as risk mitigation, how contracts or other arrangements with patients or alternative strategies, urine checking, that sort of thing, really work. So again, in the interest of perhaps being too brief, but nevertheless, the research questions pretty much organize themselves around those topics. So the comparative effectiveness of long-term opiate use versus placebo for long-term pain, function, and quality of life, and long-term opiate use with alternative pain strategies. That's actually the one that caught the eye of the Improving Healthcare Systems, discussed it at great length with a tremendous amount of support from our panel, was really to look at it because alternative pain strategies can be seen as kind of a systems approach. We're not just talking about one prescriber, one patient, or even one institution, but really thinking about the numerous different ways of mitigating pain that we really would involve more of a systems approach. Again, as going back to the research questions, a better understanding of the harms and adverse events, you know, what are the specific types or causes of pain that lend themselves to long-term opiate use? What are the patient characteristics? Because there is some variation based on race or gender or comorbidities. And then the last group of research questions that kind of bucket around the concept of dosing strategies. So the initiation, escalation, maintenance over the long term, tapering, withdrawal, and I already mentioned special populations such as pregnant women and newborns. We in New Hampshire did a quick little review of because we are small, we can actually look at all of our opiate treatment centers and say, hey, share some data with us and share what you know about use in pregnant women. And long story short, not much. We really don't have good guidelines. And without those good guidelines, the dosing guidelines, it's going to be hard to study harms and adverse events. So my personal preference in approaching the potential research questions would be reflecting again the panel that I sit on is to consider the comparative effectiveness of opiate use, long-term opiate use, alone or in combination with alternative pain strategies. I would say the second most compelling topic that's presented in this brief and coming from the Improving Healthcare Systems panel would be to look at dosing strategies, again, for some of those clinical circumstances and special populations. And probably knowing something about dosing strategies is going to be necessary to study harms and benefits, so I would put that big bucket as probably the third in the list. And that's it, unless we want to follow up with some questions.
Thank you, Doris. Yeah, that's good. So I think basically I'll turn it over to Al, and we can have a general discussion here.
Exactly, Dave. I think the floor is open, and I think it'd be great to talk about this topic in a little bit more depth. So does anyone, if anybody would like to enter into the conversation, just go ahead and do so.
Al, this is Alan. I'm sorry. This is Alan Rosenberg, and Doris, thanks for your excellent summary of what is, from my perspective as well, is a significant question, in terms of its comparative effectiveness. But as you pointed out, there are many different subjects here regarding potential research questions, specificity of conditions, because chronic pain across different types of situations is probably different in terms of effectiveness. And I'm assuming what we're looking at is relative benefit and harms of this strategy. But I just reiterate, I think the strategy of looking at this for a specific condition, say chronic low back pain, as compared to alternative treatment strategies, including interventions with injections, other types of things, or alternative medication strategies, meaning not using narcotics, opioids rather, but using others in terms of relative risk and benefit, is an opportunity for comparative effectiveness to enhance our education and knowledge base about when it may be better or not better to use these drugs with their potential complications as compared to alternatives.
This is Liz Jacobs from the Disparities Panel. I also agree this is a really important area for investigation, and there are many avenues, as summarized in the brief as well as in this conversation. I also want to say, as a practicing general internist who encounters these issues every time I'm in my clinic, that I think that patient-centeredness part of this is extraordinarily critical, because what happens a lot of times is that patients see us as denying use of opiates for reasons that have to do with us, and to be able to talk to them about how, you know, research was done really with the patient's outcomes in mind and what patients told us were important, and this is what we found, I think would be really helpful to create trust also as people apply these rubrics in terms of the best way to use opiates in ways that protect patients from harm. So I think that patient-centeredness of this and the opportunity to do very patient-centered research in this area is extremely critical and important.
Hi, this is Marcia Rupnow. I just want to echo the comment about patient-centeredness. Often in the studies of pain management, I see use or overuse of just the pain scale, the simple VAS scale, and the other endpoints are not more consistently studied. And so I'm happy to see here that it acknowledged pain function and quality of life, but I think patient preferences as related to the goals that the patient is trying to achieve, it's not just pain control. Sometimes the patient is okay if the pain control is not to the extreme, but the other aspects like the cognitive function is important, or the GI side effects are very detrimental to some patients. And so those types of patient preferences being folded into the research that is conducted, I feel is important, so that patient-centeredness should be emphasized.
Thanks very much. Other comments or other thoughts about this topic?
This is Fatima.
What?
Sorry, we had two at once.
Why don't you go first? Yeah, I'll go next. Sure. So this is Daniel, and you know, my only comment is, you know, I'm from Wisconsin, and we've had a lot of headlines regarding the massive amount of overprescription of opiates throughout our VA center. And one of the areas that I'm particularly interested in is how this affects. And I'm going to refer to them as an at-risk population or a vulnerable population, which is our veterans who seem to take a big hit when it comes to the number of prescriptions of opiums that are written.
Thank you. Thanks, Daniel. Would someone else who wanted to...
Yes. This is Betty.
This is Seema.
Go ahead, Seema.
Thanks, Betty. So I just wanted to say that one of the things that we're seeing is very different in our health system. So we're looking at chronic opioids and primary care. And one of the things that we're seeing is very different outcomes in terms of quality of life as well as utilization of other healthcare services, inappropriate emergency room use, and dissatisfaction among patients with their pain management, depending on whether there's a coincident behavioral health diagnosis along with the chronic opioid use. And in reviewing a lot of the studies of chronic opioid use, it seems as if many of them eliminate from the studies people with coexisting behavioral health diagnoses. And I think that one of the things to make this, you know, truly sort of comparative effectiveness research in the broader sense is to make sure that those patients are included and that these comparative effectiveness studies include comparative effectiveness in patients with and without coincident behavioral health diagnoses.
Okay, I think Betty, why don't you go ahead, and then I'd like to just chime in.
Okay, the one thing that I'm noticing a lack of, I didn't see anything regarding counseling, because if the goal is to get them off of the opiates, and we're going to look at how they behave after they get off the opiates, how are we going to be keeping them off the opiates? I'm not seeing where we're centering on actually giving them some kind of counseling or some type of support in that manner. And I think that's critical for somebody that's on an opiate if you're trying to get them off. But maybe it was addressed in a different fashion and I missed it. So if somebody could clear that up for me, I would appreciate it. Did I lose everybody?
This is Liz Jacobs. I think that's a really important point. A lot of the interventions around opiate use or dealing with chronic pain and what works in with conjunction with opiates or versus opiates actually have to do with like cognitive behavioral therapy, which is counseling you're talking about, and other interventions like that. I think that's a really important point. And that's, I think, some of the really important recommendations in there is thinking about what in conjunction works with it, as well as do those things work fine by themselves without opiates. I think those are some of the suggestions.
Yeah. And this is Doris, just looking at it from having studied this both in the context of this issue brief that was presented to the group, as well as just work in my professional life. There are all sorts of alternatives there. I think that the counseling and CBT is certainly in the mix and actually has some interesting early research that would say it's something that should be further explored. I think, though, to go back to Dr. Rosenberg's point when the comments were first coming in, is even though I'm a huge advocate to understand this better, I do think that it's an awfully big bite. If others disagree with me, great, then by all means, let's prioritize it at the end of the discussion. But you could address some of the same questions that are bubbled up here by taking a smaller bite, so to speak, and looking at it, you know, kind of segueing into our next topic around a particular use of long-term opiates, like, you know, chronic low back pain or, you know, something that keeps us out of that non-cancer, non-end of life. So I don't want to argue against the topic too heavily, but I do think there's some practical considerations in moving forward, making this a funding opportunity that needs to be considered as well. Is this simply, you know, too big to get our arms around? And how could we capture what's meaningful out of this opportunity, especially, again, given the improving healthcare systems, those alternative strategies How could we do that and maybe explore that in the confines of one or a few diseases?
This is Linda. I agree with that. Also, Betty, I was a little concerned just with the phrasing of our, if our goal is to get people off opioid treatment, because there probably is some appropriate use of an appropriate dosage of opioids for some patients. So I think we're going to have to be very clear in this research question if we're going to have meaningful results, because this is a huge issue and so many factors involved that I'm like the other speaker, it's a bit overwhelming.
Yes. Hi, this is Al Mushman again. Yeah, I think we've heard, and I think it's been a great discussion about the importance of this topic, and I think it's fair to say that there would be none if few people who really would see this as an inconsequential issue. But the question that I think we have to address, and maybe we could talk about next for a little while, is one that was alluded to just now, and that is, what is there an opportunity for PCORI in terms of a research agenda in this area that's going to make a meaningful contribution and going to lead to improvements in healthcare and patient-centered outcomes in the future? So maybe we could have some comments. And I would invite people both on the panels as well as the staff to try to envision a research agenda in this area to mix with the notion of the importance of this problem.
Al, this is Michael. Michael Duane, as I work with Doris on the Improving Health Systems panel, and I just wanted to mention two real brief things. Doris alluded to this earlier, and we discussed it on the Improving Health Systems panel, that the topic briefs didn't really quite capture some of the U.S. agency policies and regulations and agency programs that overlay this. I just want to mention one in particular. AHRQ has a prevention and chronic care program, and that program talks about the effectiveness and risks of long-term opioid treatment of chronic pain. So, I think it may be helpful to at least, be aware of that as we develop, research questions. And then the other thing is, I think that there's a tremendous need for research in this area. And as we all see that there's a void in the patient-centeredness part of this. And I also didn't see anything on the whole concept of shared decision-making and how that can affect the care. So I just want to point that out. Thank you.
And this is Cindy. I wanted to echo some of the things that people were saying, but I'm wondering if the question should really be the comparative effectiveness of treatments for chronic non-cancer pain. And, of course, long-term opioid treatment would be in there, but I think that we should be asking questions about the comparative effectiveness of different treatments, and that long-term opioids are only one of those alternatives. So I would have liked to have seen in this brief some more information about the alternatives and some information about the evidence regarding the alternatives. And I think that we should have questions that address the benefits and harms of any of various different treatments and not specifically focused on opioids.
While they aren't well, defined, though, Cindy, this is Seema, while they haven't done a good job of saying exactly what they are, on page 10, they certainly do talk about, this issue of needing in patients with chronic pain, what is the comparative effectiveness of opioids versus non-opioid therapies, both pharmacological and non-pharmacological? And then they also say, in patients with chronic pain, what is the comparative effectiveness of opioids plus non-opioid interventions? So they certainly do bring it up, although I agree with you that they haven't given us much guidance about, you know, what the options are and what we already know versus what gaps are left in what we know about non-opioid management of chronic pain. But I don't think they left it out entirely. And I agree with you that that's probably a very important piece. If you're going to say that it's possible that in some populations, for some groups, opioids are overprescribed, although we think that in some groups they may be underprescribed, you know, that's important to say, well, but chronic pain control is still important, and so what are the options?
The member, hi, it's Al. The members of the panel feel that a research agenda that's based on a randomized trial or a series of randomized trials comparing, as Cindy points out, various strategies for the management of pain, one of which would be opioids, would be practical and attractive for PCORI to do, or how do people feel about the potential for observational research to shed light on this? Or do
this
we
is
feel
now
like
given the subjective nature of pain and the known significant placebo effects of alternatives in treatment of pain, I think to do it in a setting other than RCT is unlikely to get, I'm sorry, this is Alan, but is unlikely to get to substantive additional information for us in terms of what is the proper place for opioid therapy.
This is Doris.
I'm sorry, I didn't need to cut in there. No, I guess I did. But and I don't see how you do on something quite this objective anything but a well-structured trial, not observation.
This is Jim Pantelis. I think part of the problem that I have with this is that it gets really vague in some ways. If we have an understanding, and Dan's point to the fact that opioids tend to be overprescribed or seem to be overused in the VA system, I think that points at a different issue. You know, and I don't know that we're seeing the issue here. Chronic pain, in a lot of ways, is tied to PTSD. Do we have an idea of which forms of what the diseases are that lead to the highest incidence of opioid abuse? Do we have an idea of whether or not those are tied to other factors that we can also be looking at? When you look at a VA population, a high degree of those people have got PTSD. And if you're not treating the PTSD, then you give them opioids. Just my opinion.
Jim, this is Martha. I'm not sure I agree with that. I do think I support Alan that a randomized clinical trial, given the variability in treatment context and diagnosis, is necessary. But I think we need to be careful about stereotyping vets with PTSD and saying that, you know, drug treatment is sort of uniformly slapped on. I actually live with a vet, and I'm not sure that they would agree with that.
And this is Doris. I also want to amplify what Alan said as well. We essentially in New Hampshire did an observational study, and the prescribing patterns are so heterogeneous, and the patients and their pain and the other variables are so complex and confounding that lacking any rigor, I don't think we're going to contribute any science.
Thank you. Okay, so I think we really need to, I'm sorry to cut off the discussion. I know there's a lot of people who probably have additional thoughts. and we'll hopefully have time to circle back. But I think we need to summarize this topic and move on. I'll start with a little bit of summary, Marty, and then please add. I think there's sort of universal feeling that this is an important topic and one that PCORI should address. In all likelihood, it's going to require a large-scale randomized controlled trial in order to do so. But importantly, it would be a randomized controlled trial on management strategies, including systems of pain treatment. One intervention among those would be opioids, among a group of other, a family of other interventions as well. Marty, would you add anything to the summary then?
Sure. I agree with you, Al, that, you know, what I heard consensus is this is a very important area, but also, to paraphrase, a big bite of could we target issues within this more specifically. Some of the issues that we might want to focus on would be better explanation of the alternatives and evidence for benefits and treatments and harms of many diagnoses with and without the use of opiates, as Cindy mentioned. We also need to be aware of other policies and programs that address these, in particular the ARC program on chronic care and that was mentioned. Frankly, there's little evidence-based practice to guide opiate use, despite that it's an epidemic, along with an increase in neonatal addiction syndrome, and with the important caveat of excluding cancer and end-of-life pain. The main issues that were brought up that might guide a randomized clinical trial, as well as other scientific exploration, include the context. That this muddles sort of the clarity of the research questions. There's a need to consider the patient-centeredness of back pain, chronic pain, and opiate management. And a point was brought up that there's a void here, and that better understanding of goals and research will actually increase patient trust in provider management and protect patients from the harms of this. In particular, some of the issues that might be important to patients in the context would be the balance between pain control and cognitive function and GI symptoms. It was brought up that vets may be a unique population, that there's variations in patient outcomes, and that we would like to be sure to include patients with behavioral health difficulties and in addition provide support and counseling for those both on and off opioids. Anybody want to add that?
Thanks, Marty. I think what
Alan,
we'll do now...
Alan, can I just challenge one thing that you said there, because I'm not sure that it represents it tells the whole story. You indicated the comment that was made, and accurately so, that CER comparing opioid and non-opioid or even non-pharmacological treatments was an area that the panel wanted to explore. But I don't want to shortchange the other half of this. As Doris, you know, described opioid use as, I think, accurately as an epidemic. So exploring alternative treatments is one way perhaps to avoid sending people down that road. But given the 5 to 8 million people currently prescribed opioids, I think that the other half of the research that's recommended and out around page 10 that goes to all of those dosing and utilization questions shouldn't be ignored. So I don't think we should I think we need a balance between opioid versus non-opioid and then all of the research questions about how best to use opioids.
Sure. Thanks very much, Bruce. Okay, I think what I will do now is turn it back over to you, Dave, to introduce the second topic within this group on chronic pain.
Thank you very much, Al. So we're now going to go to the next phase of the chronic pain discussion, which is low back pain, for which there is a separate topic brief, and Karen Chesbro will be discussing this topic.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Low back pain is one of those specific areas. I think that umbrellas the other two topics really nicely in an area that you can really focus on some of these other issues. The brief that was presented did a pretty good job summing up the main issues and covering some of the studies that are out there right now and some of the things that are lacking in those studies. And the brief presented 9 research questions that they wanted us to focus on for that. And many questions included the use of opiates, and that indeed is an important area within the treatment of low back pain that more information could be used on. One of the questions focused on using opiates in a combination therapy with another intervention that could gain some good information out of. And then one question that really represented the theme across the other topics was doing a study specifically on people on long-term opioids, comparing low back pain interventions as adjunctive therapy to enhance withdrawal. And then looking at the second set of research questions down from NIAMS down there, the issue of operating on low back pain versus non-operative therapies is really a big issue, I think, for a lot of practitioners in low back pain right now, because specifically up to 40% of low back pain operations fail. So many practitioners out there think that there needs to be some good research on identifying patients who would really benefit from surgical management versus those who might do better in other non-surgical management practices. One of the other questions that really stuck out in the research questions, too, is that there seems like there is a disconnect between evidence and practice, that it's PT or other practices in the management of low back pain is so variable. It's really hard to implement some of these evidence-based guidelines in the treatment. It just is that variable. But just to keep it short so there can be some discussion in this, I think I would agree with one of the statements in the brief that says a randomized control trial would really help answer some of the questions and maybe provide some comparative effectiveness research that patients could use to decide what course they want to do. Okay, that's it.
Great, thanks very much. So again, comments, and let's hear comments. I think if we can try to combine people's comment, if you can, when you make a comment, if you can try to combine your sense of the importance of this topic with your thoughts about a research opportunity for PCORI, that would, I think, would be an efficient way to use our time on the phone. So I'm asking for people to come forward with thoughts about the importance of this topic, namely opioid, as well as other treatments, the treatment of low back pain, but certainly with an emphasis on opioids, the importance and the opportunity, yes or no, that PCORI has to fashion a research agenda around this topic.
Can I just ask a question? This is Kathy Ansel.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I'm a little confused about the heterogeneity of the topic area. I mean, do we have any appreciation or understanding with whether or not we can get better specificity in the kind of problem? I mean, low back pain seems that there would be a number of different factors that could be the causal factor for low back pain. So, you know, the only thing that I would ask is that if a study were called for, that there be some specificity in what is it we're trying to compare for what group of people, for what problem.
Kathy, this is Angie Smith. Hey, I was thinking about the same thing. What struck me here is that I think an opportunity for PCORI is a large-scale trial that gets at the heterogeneity of the disease. I think that there is so much, and being a urologist, it's funny, I actually get a lot of people with back pain in my clinic. If they end up not having stones, they actually end up having something else. But there's a lot of heterogeneity there. The primary care doctors often don't know what to do with these patients. And I think there are these subsets. Some will be, you know, treated in one way. Others will be treated another way. We really have, I feel like there's no guidance in terms of, you know, what risk factors are in this group, what risk factors are in this group. And so, to me, the opportunity for a large-scale trial to get at this heterogeneity would be key. And then using what is gained in that trial to then kind of tailor intervention. So not necessarily single trials for single things, but maybe a larger scale trial to get at, you know, to get at the various, you know, types of people with low back pain and which treatments seem to work best for each of them.
Yeah, this is Michael Duanis from Improving Healthcare Systems. I just want to mention one other thing that this in particular really ties to prevention. So again, it goes back to what's the cause of the low back pain. But this even talks about the idea of behavior modification. How a sedentary lifestyle, how obesity fits into this, central obesity, and lack of core strength, especially relating to, let's say, PT correction. So I'm just mentioning that, you know, maybe the kind of study that we need is more of a longitudinal, you know, prospective study so that we can see what the results of the interventions, you know, are. So I just thought I'd mention that. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is Alan Rosenberg again. And as just said, there's a wide number of very important subjects in chronic pain, low back pain. I'm going to address one, I think, based on disparity between, you know, what is publicly available and the payer medical policies and specialty societies is an ongoing major subject of disagreement that for people in a patient-centered way is a key question. And that's for individuals with a very specifically degenerative disc disease with chronic pain that doesn't respond to other conservative therapies after 3 or 6 months or some period of time, what is the benefit of spinal fusion versus harms as compared to continuing or using alternative conservative therapies? It has been a subject debated for years, but not really evaluated in terms of a substantive issue. It is a common procedure in this country with significant impact on people. And we have this significant disparity between the surgical, predominantly but not solely surgical, specialty societies that support it and most of the many, I shouldn't say most, but from when we scan the environment, the payer communities that say it remains not medically necessary or investigational. And I think to get to an answer for the people of this country, it is one of the most pressing, specific, comparative effectiveness issues to be addressed as a society for the citizens of the country.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan. Other comments? Again, a comment about that importance and an idea of how it would be addressed.
This is Priti.
After you, Priti.
Okay.
Go ahead,
so, I just wanted to add a little bit on the heterogeneity issue. I completely agree with what was said earlier. However, because of the fact that it's so broad, we still have to kind of narrow the research question because even if you try to design a study, a randomized controlled trial, to get to the heterogeneity, it's still very, very broad.
Hey, hold on. I think I'm good.
If you're not speaking, can you mute your phone, please? We're getting some background noise.
Great. Go ahead, Priti.
That was done. I was just trying to make
okay.
a point. Yeah.
I think someone else wanted to make a comment.
Thanks, Al. Bruce Monti, yes, I did. So looking at this from the purchaser and the employer point of view, I'd like to just echo what Alan said about the significance of this. Every year, musculoskeletal issues are among the top three in terms of employer cost at virtually every large employer, and this is a big driver. So I think this one's critically important. It has a significant impact on the productivity of the workforce, as well as on the cost burden for purchasers of healthcare. In terms of the kind of the details, I think. The other thing I'll say is that another reason that PCORI can really add value here. I've been at an employer that actually tried to do its own low back study, and frankly, as a number of folks have mentioned, due in part I think to the heterogeneity of the condition, that was not a large enough group to deliver effective research, and so this really does call for larger scale trials. And then in terms of the comparative effectiveness areas, I actually thought that the focus, there were a couple of different sets of questions, and the second set of questions coming from Dr. Panagis, I believe, that focused on comparing operative versus non-operative management and other associated questions felt like they were clearer and more likely to yield useful outcomes. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. Let me just ask.
Karen,
hi, it's Al. Just 1 second here. If, you know, low back pain has been a topic that we've been aware of since the start of our panel, which initially, you know, when we started with the advisory panel, it was actually a topic that was, I think, prioritized by PCORI even before the advisory panels were in place and providing input. If you or Dave or perhaps others there could bring us up to date about where this topic has gone within the PCORI infrastructure, if you will, and whether there are any current plans in place or additional thinking that we should be aware of to indicate a possible direction that PCORI is thinking about taking with low back pain. This is the only topic that I would ask that about because it's just been around for so long.
Yes. Well, I was a member of the advisory panel when we chose low back pain and then chose to focus on the transition from kind of intermittent back pain to everyday chronic back pain. And in our first or second round of our large clinical pragmatic clinical studies program, we funded a big randomized trial, I think from the University of Pittsburgh, I remember Dave, you're going to have to help me here, but one of the basic novel intervention was a combination of sort of cognitive behavioral therapy linked with and provided by physical therapists and rehab medicine folks. Dave, do you want to fill in the missing blanks there?
Yes, it's essentially a study of an expanded role for physical therapists in the management of people with recurrent episodic low back pain. And as Hal mentioned, it's sort of incorporating a counseling and symptom management role with more conventional physical therapy approaches. And it was a study that was well received in our merit review process, seemed to represent sort of current thinking about how to use an interdisciplinary approach to the management of episodic low back pain.
And the fingerprints of the advisory panel are all over this one, so feel good.
Yeah.
But how, maybe you can say how then the topic has kind of come back around again?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's come back around really in response to the same kind of thinking that I've been hearing in the last hour, which is particularly if you're, which is that you've got to study specific conditions, particularly if you want to look at the adjunctive role of treating the specific condition in trying to reduce the need for heavy-duty medications and opioids. So it's in that context, I think, that it's before you today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just another I gather that opioids were not part of the study strategy in the already funded project?
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, we're going to have to wrap this up pretty quickly. Again, I think this has been a great discussion, and I think obviously there's a lot of enthusiasm for this. We know that it impacts the healthcare system in almost every way that one can think of, and certainly it's a disease condition that accounts for a lot of expenditures and a lot of time lost from work and a lot of anguish by healthcare, the people who cover healthcare, including the insurance companies that provide funding for healthcare. And so it's an important area. There's very great heterogeneity. Within this topic that would have to be considered. And I think we're hearing that, again, randomized trials would probably be virtually the only way to untangle the comparative effectiveness questions that underlie this topic. One of which would be opioids versus other alternative measures for managing the problem. Marty, if you could just try to be brief in your summarization, and then we'll move on.
Thanks, Al. Just to add to what you said and sort of a overt observation, I think sort of the randomness, confusion, and multiple-faceted discussion we're having is a microcosm of what we've had. As Hal says, this topic's been around before. We're wrestling with it the same way the country, the payers, and the physicians are wrestling with it. The main points, just to not repeat but to add to what you said, Al, that it is condition-specific, and there's a disconnect between evidence and practice. It's hard to implement treatment guidelines. Because it's so heterogeneous, there's no guidance on relative risk factors as well as who various treatments actually work for. So we need to target and drill down, specify some of the research questions to gather these data. And there was a suggestion this may also be done better with the use of longitudinal data, taking in a preventive focus, maybe after treatment has occurred or maybe even before problems occur for those at risk, such as those who are obese or those who lack core strength. And finally, the option of fusion as a very specific consideration in treatment for back pain was introduced by our payers, in part responding to the large employer burden and cost of low back pain, and in part because this is an ongoing debate about how best to treat degenerative disc disease.
Thanks, Marty. Okay, Dave, back to you for the introduction of chronic pain, colon, musculoskeletal pain.
First of all, congratulations to the panel. I think we're only maybe 6 or 7 minutes behind schedule. We're doing really well in moving through these topics. So this is the third piece of the chronic pain topic, which is focusing on musculoskeletal pain. And it's going to be introduced by Priti Jingran, member of the APTO panel.
Thank you, David. So there's obviously a lot of overlap and some of the points which were made earlier for the first two write-ups to a certain extent apply here too. But just to provide a little bit of an overview about the chronic musculoskeletal pain, as the name suggests, it's musculoskeletal in nature, and there is no identifiable underlying disorder. Per definition, it states that if the pain is not resolved within 3 to 6 months is when it is then considered chronic in nature. I said earlier for the previous two write-ups, if you read this summary, what you would also conclude in here also is the fact that there's a lot of variation in the type of studies which have been done to better understand various different aspects of chronic musculoskeletal pain. The heterogeneity of the issue is also a major confounding variable here, primarily because there are so many factors which could cause the pain, and there are so many outcomes which could be of relevance and importance here. However, it's still a topic which is very patient-centered, just that the assessment of the actual musculoskeletal pain is very patient-focused and is patient-reported. And in addition to that, outcomes which are of importance here are also very patient-centered. As was said earlier, this is a major concern for health plans and payers, primarily because it has a significant impact on quality of life, functionality, returning back to work, stress. The list is long. As far as the management of chronic musculoskeletal pain is concerned, per guidelines, the first level of management, as the write-up suggests, is at the primary care setting. And there are various different kind of approaches, even at the primary care setting, which have been outlined in the write-up. But the second set of management is really where you have a multidisciplinary team and the patient is being managed with multiple different components being involved, which could range anywhere from medical therapy, behavioral therapy, physical reconditioning, and education. In all the work which has been reported so far, any studies, systematic reviews which have been done, again, the rigor of the research is relatively low, and therefore there are no conclusive studies to better understand what works best in which type of patient. As far, and that applies both to the the level one management, which is the primary care setting management, as well as the level two management. So hence, as was previously stated for the other topics which we have talked or discussed today, some of the issues are very common across all three. The primary research questions which are of interest here are on page 28 and 29, I believe, and some of the ones which are outlined here are: what are the comparative effectiveness of different tools, modules, technologies which are being used at the primary care setting to manage the patients as well as in educating the primary care providers? In addition to that, there's a lot of interest in better understanding the outcomes when there is shared decision-making with the physician, primarily because for something like pain management, patient empowerment and patient involvement has a significant impact on outcomes. Other topics which, again, have been outlined are, what are the comparative effectiveness of various patient decision aids which may be available for primary care physicians and patients. When it comes to better understanding the impact of multidisciplinary programs, a topic which, or a research question which has been outlined, is the comparative effectiveness of having an inpatient multidisciplinary program versus an outpatient multidisciplinary program. And then the last is the comparative effectiveness of alternative models for coordinated pain management. And that is the one which, to be honest, for me was the most interesting, especially knowing we're focusing so much on coordinated care as a part of the Affordable Care Act and implementing systems which really provide an opportunity to provide coordinated care. So if we are able to leverage some of the new delivery models and focus on comparative effectiveness of these alternative models for coordinated care in these patients, I think that would be a really timely research question and one which would add a lot to really understanding whether the delivery systems which have been implemented more recently truly have an impact in managing the patient better. So again, just to conclude, a lot of commonality in terms of the gaps in research, as discussed with the previous topics, and as far as really honing on the research question, which is important here. Again, what I struggle with is the heterogeneity of the topic. So it'll be really critical to really pin down some very specific research questions so that you can come up with some conclusive research and guide patients and physicians in terms of how to best manage musculoskeletal pain.
Thanks, Brittany.
That's it, David.
Okay, great. Okay, the floor is open for people's thoughts. Again, the topic, this issue of heterogeneity has come up, and reasonably so, because these topics are within themselves quite heterogeneous. I think what we're hearing, though, is that the first cut at trying to create some homogeneity is the division of this topic of chronic pain into the three categories that we're talking about today, namely long-term opioid use for chronic pain, back pain, and musculoskeletal pain. So now people, I think, should keep in mind we're talking about patients who would not have low back pain or not have non-cancer-related pain that is due to or thought to be due to some musculoskeletal disorder. But what is the opportunity, what is the importance, and what is the opportunity for PCORI to envision a research agenda in this third category, individuals who are felt to have a musculoskeletal origin for their pain. It's not low back pain. What's the importance of that, and what are the research opportunities? So the floor is open.
Hey, this is Angie. I had a couple of comments about the potential research questions they've brought forth in this topic brief. The first question I had was, first of all, they kind of separate into level one and level two. And in level one, they talk about shared decision making and decision aids. And to me, talking about comparative effectiveness of decision aids is a little bit premature when, the first question, which is the comparative effectiveness of different tools and technology and about this pain management is really unknown. So really, what kind of decision aids are we really even comparing here, and we don't even really know how we should be treating these patients. The second comment I have is that, especially because this topic brief is really about systems, I was kind of surprised they divided up level one and level two. To me, a question that was sort of lacking, and maybe I missed it, was really comparing whether a multidisciplinary program is better than these patients just seeing their primary care provider. Because it seems to me earlier in the brief, there really is no good evidence that the multidisciplinary program is effective. And I know we don't talk about cost here in the setting of a question, but that sort of makes me think, well, multidisciplinary program, if it's not actually effective, it's certainly more costly. So maybe thinking about the question of whether PCP versus a multidisciplinary program in and of itself is a CER question.
Additional comments or thoughts?
Michael, just in following up with that comment just then, the one thing that this might lend itself to then is the fact that, there are tools available that can complement what the primary care physician is doing. But many of these tools are developed outside of the U.S. So some of them are decision guides from Canada, from Europe. And I'm just wondering if maybe that is an area that could be explored. Thank you.
Mm-hmm, thanks. Okay. All right. I personally think that probably the reason that we're not having much discussion about this is that the members of the panel feel that the issues that we brought up already are pertinent with regard to this topic as well. So I would just start the summarization by saying I think within the category, certainly if one were to look at the question of the use of opioids, within that category would be the three that have been identified: a non-cancer but not musculoskeletal pain, a low back pain, and here musculoskeletal pain. And musculoskeletal pain is an important condition leading to the use of opioids, and part of the reason that there is so much confusion about and concern about the long-term use of opioids. There's considerable heterogeneity within the musculoskeletal pain group, though. However, one would have to think about that in a study and how to deal with heterogeneity of the patient populations. And I think it would be difficult, but perhaps, if I had my own thoughts about it, difficult but perhaps not impossible to shed light on this issue without without large-scale randomized trials. But Marty, you have any other thoughts, and then we'll move on to a sort of a shift in gears to a new oral anticoagulant.
So other than reinforcing the commonality across these topics, I think what sets this particular topic apart is there is no underlying identifiable disorder, so you can't even debate a surgical treatment like fusion, as we discussed in the other, in a more Wild West topic. Rather than repeat, the only other points I would add is that in this diagnosis in particular, patient involvement appears critical, and to that end, there's been some RQs suggested on decision-making and AIDS, but I believe it was Angie brought up, is this premature, because how can you decide if you don't even know if the treatments work? So how can you decide amongst them? And what was missing, which I thought was, you know, an incredibly important point, is the distinction between a multidisciplinary approach versus a primary care approach. Is there any evidence that one is better than the other? And looking at the cost burden, which would only add to employer and payer burden for this issue.
Great. Really good.
Now, this is Cindy. I just want to add, I think from a patient perspective, the patients would want the treatment that was least complicated.
Great.
So that we need to think of sometimes the least system involvement as a potential alternative.
Here. Great. Okay. Dave, back to you for the introduction of oral anticoagulant.
Yes, thank you. So the next topic is the oral anticoagulants with a focus on the newer agents, and Diane Bild, who's a senior program officer at PCORI, will introduce the topic.
Okay, thank you, and hello, everybody. I think this topic is sort of stands in contrast from the last couple that we have just discussed, in that it's quite a rapidly moving area. The topic was presented to us as newer oral anticoagulants, and after doing a bit of research, we identified the conditions, the most common conditions in which these agents are used, and those include atrial fibrillation, treatment of deep vein thrombosis, and postoperative prevention of deep vein thrombosis, especially after total hip and knee replacement. Because this is a rapidly moving area, as I mentioned, because up until a few years ago, warfarin was the main oral agent, and a newer set of agents has emerged on the scene and is quickly taking up market share in certain treatment of certain of these conditions. And they have certain advantages in terms of needing less monitoring and a number of others that we listed in the topic brief. They are also, though, significantly more expensive, and this is part of the decision-making on the basis for some patients and payers that enters into the equation. So the topic brief sort of quickly gets split almost into three topics, and they are not the issues are not exactly the same for all three. In treatment of non-valvular, that is, atrial fibrillation, we do see some variability in the treatment guidelines, but there does seem to be a movement towards the newer anticoagulants. However, as we found in clinicaltrials.gov and in other reviews, there are quite a few ongoing studies in this area, and some of the comments that we received along the way in developing this brief is that this is quite an active area, so I'd be very curious in the panel's comments as to whether this is a time for PCORI to get involved. With regard to treatment of deep vein thrombosis, again, this is, in general, this is treated initially with sub-Q heparin, and there is a recent movement towards trying these newer anticoagulants. So again, that's a little bit of a moving target. And finally, with regard to post-op treatment, something of the same picture with regard to recent studies and recent movement towards using these agents. There, as I mentioned, there are many studies in atrial fibrillation, a hefty number in DVT, perhaps fewer in the surgical field. So as a result of this, the questions that we put forth in front of you today are rather general. They probably need to be drilled down a little bit further. And because, again, we have these three conditions, and some of the questions that came up through consultation with some clinical expert along the way include a very general statement about comparing harms and benefits among these newer agents. We got variable opinions from our clinician experts about the value of that. The second question here is comparing the harms and benefits of warfarin versus NOACs. And again, because there's sort of this trend towards the NOACs, it's a very active area. And then the third question has to do with there is some limitation of the NOACs in with regard to renal dysfunction, so that creates a different set of harms and benefits for that particular population. So these are the general questions, and we would be very interested in your feedback about them.
Diane, thanks very much. Before opening it up for comments, let me ask you a question, Diane. It seems to me that the literature has already clarified that NOACs compared to warfarin are probably equally effective and cause a little bit less serious bleeding pretty much across the board. And I don't think, I'd be very interested to hear from others, but I don't think there's a lot of clinical controversy about that. However, they're much more expensive, but along with being more expensive, they are much more, considerably more convenient to take and less prone to errors in the administration, particularly since people don't have to have regular blood tests to manage the dosage. So is the fact that this topic was identified as important by the Scientific Oversight Committee a reflection of a lack of confidence in the way I've just summarized the literature with regard to NOACs versus warfarin? Or was it because the committee felt that this was that there was a lot of uncertainty about the comparative effectiveness of the various newer agents? Can you help us with that?
Well, I will respond a little bit. I don't know how much I can really help because I completely agree with what you said about the apparent benefits or the ease of administration, use of the NOACs, less monitoring, some early studies that make them appear to be equal, if not beneficial. There are still issues regarding costs, which I think create this decision for some patients. And then there are some of these other nuances that were laid out in the brief. For example, there's some perception that the NOACs cannot be reversed if there is bleeding. Actually, there are some agents, but they don't seem to be as well utilized, and there are going to be some specific agents coming out on the market that will reverse the bleeding tendency, and no whereas warfarin, we know that we can reverse it with vitamin K. But in answer to your main question, I actually don't. We didn't get much information, unless somebody else got information, about the genesis of this question, what prompted the SOC to propose it. It was sort of just delivered in three words, newer oral anticoagulants. But maybe Hal or Dave can fill in the gaps if it's known.
No, I don't. I think that this did come in through sort of stakeholder contacts in terms of a priority topic, but it was pushed by the Board of Governors.
This is Seema. So I'm just curious as to whether some of this has to do with the fact that there's been, in a way, better comparative effectiveness or just better effectiveness research prior to release of the newer drugs than there was to warfarin. And so, for example, you know, we're dealing with, like, these issues of discontinuation of anticoagulation during minor surgery and the fact that it's probably over-discontinued because the providers don't see the stroke-type adverse events that occur when you discontinue the anticoagulation, whereas they do see the bleeding events because that's what comes back to their office, to the dentist or the joint surgeon or whatever, the gastroenterologist doing a colonoscopy. And so, like, what we're seeing, you know, what we're hearing about, what we're doing research on is this question of whether, you know, one, do we really understand patient preferences around bleeding versus stroke and how you make that decision about discontinuation, but two, that the newer drugs all actually have much stronger warnings about discontinuation because now it's known that discontinuation increases stroke risk, and warfarin doesn't actually have like a black box warning about that. And so I just wonder if some of the need for this from the payers, providers side, you know, so the stakeholder side, I guess, is to have sort of equivalent effectiveness and adverse event information about warfarin that we actually already have about the newer agents. And I'm just guessing. I mean, you know, obviously I have no knowledge.
This is Alan Rosenberg and running, you know, our pharmacy benefit stuff for, you know, Anthem, you know, many millions of Americans through it. I think I have a fair knowledge base on why this might be of interest, but I actually disagree with some of the points in the issue brief as well, Al, you know, respectfully with one of your statements. I think, you know, to start with, the first major trial on the bigotrin versus warfarin, a multi-center, very large trial, actually showed a significant, statistically significant, but our committees felt clinically significant difference in individuals with AFib treated with this, with the Pradaxa, significant improvement in stroke rates as compared to warfarin therapy. So there's a lot of, there are additional studies and different situations. Yep. Some non-inferiority, but some, and trade-offs, higher GI rates, but much lower significance of the GI bleeds than of the strokes and heart attacks. So there are a variety of factors here that I think are of import. I'm actually puzzled in the brief that they say that most of the payer organizations don't cover these agents. Costs are often not covered by insurance and under the reference 6. And I think for specific situations, they may not be covered. But largely, I actually think most payers today probably do cover these drugs. So that's a puzzle. The actual cost differential that's been put into this brief isn't a full and accurate reflection of the cost differential because it's just the drug costs. But the monitoring costs of individuals on warfarin include blood draws, frequent physician visits, et cetera, that may be different than these other agents. So what is the real issue, and why do I think many payers are interested in this? I think because there's a lack of head-to-head trials of these agents. There's an expanding repertoire of diagnoses that they're being used for, and the question is, what are the relative benefits and complications? And as these drugs have become broadly used, you know, and they each have somewhat different FDA-labeled indications, by the way. But and finally, as these drugs get used more frequently and more extensively, we are seeing populations at risk for some of them based on renal function, based on age, et cetera. What can we learn in terms of the relative safety? As you've pointed out, these are not easily reversible drugs, unlike warfarin. So what are the trade-offs, as pointed out, in terms of patient-centeredness about relative risks and benefits over broader populations? So I think it's actually a very substantive. I think many payers are interested in it, but I'd say most payers that I'm aware of, from what we see in our competitor analyses, are paying for these drugs.
So, Alan, that's very helpful. Let me just a clarification. So what you're saying is the important questions are among these newer agents, what is the comparative effectiveness of A, B, C, and D? Not the question, not the question of NOACs versus warfarin.
One is the comparative effectiveness among the class, and the different conditions. And two, it still is, as we're beginning to see greater complications as they're used more frequently in the community at large. So this one is actually one where it would be interesting look at from the networks whether the complication rates of these in actual use in the community reflect the same complication rates as reported in the study. So there are a variety of things that would be...
Sure, the effectiveness versus efficacy question. Cindy, I know you had a thought.
Yeah, I agree with what's been said. I just want to say that I think some people are having a concern that the consequences of non-adherence to NOHACs, so the consequences of non-adherence on almost a daily basis may be greater than the consequences of non-adherence to warfarin, actually. And so
is because you can monitor whether people are adhering to warfarin by their, by PT, which you can't do with these.
And the trials have been in efficacy situations. I agree that there are still effectiveness questions out there and that adherence is part of that.
Okay.
This is Angie.
Just a second. So just to be sure then, so Cindy, what you're saying is the question of NOACs versus warfarin in the effectiveness environment, that is in the pragmatic environment, is still an open question and an important one.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think in some situations, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. I rudely interrupted someone who wanted to say.
It's Angie. I just wanted to point out that what I think is an important question. My concern, and, being a surgeon myself, I deal with these NOACs all the time. I mean, there's definitely things that we don't understand. Like, for example, how long should a patient be off of the NOAC before surgery? And those kinds of things. So I think there are important questions here. My concern is that, and we kind of just very briefly, mentioned it here, but I think it's an important one, is this reversibility and the fact that there are going to be antidotes coming down the pipeline, I believe, soon. Right now, they don't exist, or at least not that I'm aware of. I haven't been able to use any for my own patients. And so I do have a concern. Maybe it's an important question. This is an important question, but the durability and doing the trial now or whatever we decide to do now, I think has a big potential for changing down the line, because once the antidotes come in, you know, some of the big risk involved with these NOACs go away. And so your answer is going to be very different when you have those in the mix. So anyway, I just want to point that out, because to me that's actually a pretty big point in terms of thinking about when we want to do and when we want to fund something like this.
Okay, thank you, Angie. Okay, we've got to have to move on. I'll briefly summarize, and I say I think there is enthusiasm. I've been hearing it for this. For this topic. It really, though, would depend upon a further definition of what the critical issue is that can be researched. But the major theme for PCORI agenda would be a real-world comparison to contrast with the results that are currently available through randomized trials, both among the newer agents, and then in the more fundamental question of the difference between these newer agents, if there is any, and warfarin. Did you hear anything else, Marty?
Yes. The way I kind of categorize this is the major issues with respect to the use of NOAC center around cost, reversibility, ease of use, and lesser required monitoring, but that it was just brought up that reversibility may lose its relevance as antidotes are developed. And the head-to-head comparisons basically center around the relative rate of complications, for example, for those who of certain age demographics, those with compromised renal function, the trade-offs, GI versus CVA bleeds, and the issue of non-adherence versus adherence.
Great. Thanks.
With
thanks
one
very
clarification,
much.
There are really no significant head-to-head trials within the class. The comparators, you're always going back there. All these studies have been done against warfarin, not against each other. So the head-to-head comparator would be amongst the class.
Amongst them.
Right. That's the CER sort of new thing, is one NOAC versus another NOAC. I agree.
Right. Right. So we've got to have time for the last topic, which I think is really fascinating, and that is the opportunities for comparative effectiveness research in schizophrenia. So, Dave, will you introduce this topic, or the because I think you're going to introduce it for us, aren't you?
Yeah. So thanks. So I don't get to turn this one over to anyone else. I'm going to introduce it myself. So. Thanks, everyone. We're doing amazingly well in terms of timetable on this call. The schizophrenia topic basically emerged through an evaluation of some direction that we had picked up in projects that have already been funded by PCORI, and sort of an effort to look at whether PCORI could kind of round out and call out its interests in the area of chronic mental illness. You may recall that there is a topic that the panel reviewed on bipolar disorder in younger individuals that's included in the pragmatic studies announcement. There also is the topic that you previously have reviewed on major depression that's going to be sort of put into the mix with these topics. But the other big piece in chronic mental illness is schizophrenia. And this is a very disabling and often lifetime disorder that's associated with a substantial amount personal distress and threats to social functioning. It's also been noted that mortality of people with schizophrenia is higher than compared to with the general population. There has been a substantial amount of research on the management of schizophrenia, and as you saw in this topic brief, we fortunately have some high-quality systematic reviews and future research need documents that have come out of both AHRQ, the NIH, and the Cochrane Library. And as those sources are analyzed, it indicates that there still are some questions, despite the fact that there's a fairly large body of evidence about antipsychotic therapy in schizophrenia, including both the first generations and the second generation antipsychotics. There continue to be questions about how to use these drugs, including questions about dosing and kind of trade-offs between side effects and antipsychotic efficacy. So there appears to be some opportunities for further research in this area, although you got to look carefully because there's been quite a bit of drug trials and ongoing drug trials that are kind of in the pipeline. Also, a lot of questions about how other modalities of treatment, both other medications as well as psychotherapeutic, sort of non-drug psychotherapeutic interventions are used in this disorder, and that's called out with some of the newer trends for such interventions as collaborative care and assertive community treatment. Finally, there's a lot of interest in the early mortality in schizophrenia, which has been a concern because of the hypothesis that side effects to the second generation antipsychotics may aggravate the increased cardiovascular mortality that occurs in schizophrenia. So there are some proposals for further research in comparing the second generation antipsychotic drugs as well as adjunctive types of interventions such as lifestyle interventions, sort of diet, exercise type approaches, and continuing questions about interventions to help people with schizophrenia stop the use of tobacco products, and some opportunities for further research because of the concern that although there's an extensive evidence base on the effectiveness of smoking cessation strategies, they are not particularly, or there may be questions about their applicability to the population of people with schizophrenia. And basically, I think the issue here is where there might be a fit, where there might be some good opportunities for comparative effectiveness research, you know, in an area in which there's, already a lot of research going on. I should say that we've been making an attempt over the last month to interface with people from the National Institute of Mental Health. We've had a heck of a time actually getting them on the phone, but we do expect to be talking with them over the next 3 weeks or so. I'm sorry that we don't have that information for the discussion today.
Very good, Dave. It's really a great summary. And interestingly enough, this topic and the topic brief echoes back to our last discussions in interesting ways about newer anticoagulants. Because as you point out, here's an area like with the anticoagulant stuff where there is good evidence out there from randomized trials about the effectiveness of the newer antipsychotics versus the first-line drugs. But as with the anticoagulant issue, still a number of questions that exist about the treatment of this condition. So let's open it up for others, other people's views, again, about the importance of this topic and the opportunity for Corey to fashion a meaningful research agenda.
This is Deborah. I'd like to jump in. There is one very specific topic that it jumped out at me again and again. Obviously, this is a crucial area. This is a devastating diagnosis for the patient and the family members, and it impacts, as was so beautifully lined out, it impacts mortality and quality of life. But what I wanted to hone in on here was there was a mention that there is a moderate evidence base that behavioral interventions can alleviate weight gain. And my thinking on that is that could be a very interesting area, a very interesting focus of comparative effectiveness research, because we all know that adherence is such a critical problem with these drug agents, and that often results in a deterioration of the patient and the bottom line, mortality. The other thing is that weight gain can be associated with increased risk for the cardiovascular disease that these patients tend to have, their increased rate of diabetes. So it seems like the behavioral focus is something that hasn't been explored as much as the medication aspect. And I'm thinking that even though it sounds like it's very specific, focusing on which behavioral interventions would more effectively alleviate weight gain, I think that it could have far-reaching implications.
Hi.
Great. Thanks, Deborah.
Hi.
Yes, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Marcia Rupnow. So I have several comments here to add. One is that I do agree on the existing body of literature, some head-to-head clinical trials, mm-hmm. some of them older studies, but in any case, in many of those studies, endpoints that were used were endpoints like clinician-reported positive and negative symptom scale. And so I think there is still opportunities with respect to using more patient-centered or even looking into the family burden, family implications. And so I think in terms of the choice of the outcomes that could be used, I do mm-hmm. express enthusiasm for this topic, for the tremendous unmet need and burden that exists, and the patients and family members, caregivers, it's a tremendous burden on those patients and people around them. Another aspect that somebody mentioned was around the adherence. So adherence is a big issue in this. This patient population. So again, efficacy versus effectiveness, and what happens in the real world. And when you take into consideration adherence or lack of adherence could lead to then a cascade of relapses and other negative outcomes as well. So that is a component that needs to be introduced. And also, I'm not sure that it was as well emphasized in the brief. So I do want to bring up that component.
Thanks, Marsha.
This is Michael. I just wanted to echo those last two comments. And the whole issue of the behavioral part of this, I think, is super important. You know, people have various coping mechanisms, and when they don't take medication or they don't adhere to it, they actually look for other substances to abuse. So I think that's very key. The other thing that the brief pointed out here that I think is very, very important is the issue of trauma-informed care. Many of these people have underlying trauma in their lives, and not identifying those traumas and understanding them is a problem. And understanding them and dealing with them can help improve readmission rates, relapse, and compliance with medications. Thanks.
Great.
This is Dorian Miller. I had a question, clarifying question about the role of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. I know that they're cited in the background reading with this issue brief, but just very interested in their perspective on what they feel are the most important comparative effectiveness research questions within this area.
Did we get that, Dave?
We have not, but we certainly have contacts with that organization, and we can follow up.
Great. Okay. Well, just to keep things even between the topics, I think given that we only have a minute left, let me turn it over to you, Marty, for a very brief summary, and then what I'd like to do, maybe Dave, is be able to tell the panel of a little bit about what's coming next in terms of our work this month. So, Marty, a brief summary of the schizophrenia, and then we'd like to turn it back over to you, Dave, and then we'll adjourn.
Well, with respect to this topic, the general consensus is there's been a lot of trials comparing the drugs and efficacy of the drugs. There's been much less study on behavioral interventions. A lot of these seem to center around the concept of adherence, behavioral interventions to reduce weight gain, to reduce tobacco use, and to better understand and identify experienced trauma, which has the implications to improve many aspects of disease. So beyond drug trials, there seems to be still many gaps in how we treat schizophrenia.
Yep, very good. Dave, I'm going to turn it over to you, but let me just, and if you could adjourn the meeting after your comment, I'd just like to express my thanks to everyone for a really great call. I know the discussion was truncated, but I hope we haven't offended anybody by not being able to have more time for this discussion. So thanks, everybody, for what I thought was a very good conference call. Dave?
Yeah, thank you, Al. I just want to bring up one issue about one of the topics, which had to do with the musculoskeletal pain topic, to alert everyone to maybe you might want to go back and look at the topic brief and specifically address the issue of, that there was an interest in systems interventions for the management of this patient population, and there's actually some specific research questions in the topic brief about systems interventions. What we will now do is kind of compile the information that we got from this call, and we will be following up with you quickly. Look for an email probably tonight with sort of asking you to go through a prioritization exercise, which will include both the sort of overall topics as well as the specific research questions that have been discussed today, sort of embedded in those topics. And but we will make this as easy and straightforward for you to go through that process. So please, everyone, do that prioritization exercise. I do not expect it's going to take more than 15 minutes or so. And so look for that email from us. And I'd just like to thank everyone for all the time you put into this discussion today. I think it's been really good. And also a reminder that we've got two more webinars for the Assessment of Prevention, Diagnosis, and Treatment Options panel coming up within the next 3 weeks or so. And so I think have already communicated with you about the dates and your availability for those webinars, but your input's been really valuable to us. So we look forward to talking with you again soon. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.
Yep.
You don't put that out.
Well,
opioids or whatever, beginning of cottons or whatever, whichever one it is.
It's a huge issue, and that was just one of them we discussed in 2 hours. We discussed our issue was mental health prioritized. All these five things are important. Okay.
use gluten. And a lot of people think they're allergic to gluten. They're not. If they don't have celiac disease, they do not need to be on a gluten-free diet.
No.